Welcome to week two.
Yes.
We're working on the concept of channeling negative emotions, which we decided both have good and bad. Now, last week we gave an introduction, which we'll review in a minute, but what we're going to do for the remainder of the series is each week we're going to take a specific emotion and work through it and explore it, understand it, and understand the possibility of perhaps channeling it and expressing it in a positive way. So this week I decided to begin with the emotion of revenge. And the reason I picked that is because, first of all, it's in this, what's that? Because first of all, it's in this week's Torah portion, actually, and I thought that, well, if it's in the Torah weekly portion, that's a good one to choose, meaning the prohibition of taking revenge is in this week's portion. And also because, just on a communal level, some of the concepts we're going to talk about are very relevant to things that are happening this week, particularly in the land of Israel, which of course is on our mind, especially today, and in everyone's mind, and so on. So I thought some of the concepts will actually be very relevant, and I wanted to sort of cover them a bit. So first of all, let's just review just some of what we spoke about last week. So last week we defined emotions as responses. So an emotion in this context of this discussion is the response to response to stimulus around us, and negative emotions, of course, are things that are destructive to both ourselves and other people, and so on. We also established that every emotion has good and bad. So everything has a purpose, right? The reason that we know that everything is good and bad because everything that's created by God, including the non-tangible, like emotions, are there for a purpose because nothing is outside of His creative force. And therefore, we need to identify the bad, of course, let it go, but we also need to discover the part of it which is positive and the part of it which is good and the part of which we can utilize. However, we talked about last week three very important principles that are important to bear in mind before we embark on this journey. The first is that the whole thing is a journey, and we talked about the Chametz Matzah formula, which means that initially one cannot begin with channeling an emotion into a positive way. If an emotion is negative, you have to let it go. You have to leave it, completely surrender, confront it, do something else, replace it with something positive like the matzah concept, which is complete humility, complete surrender, get rid of all the stuff that gets in the way that is remotely connected with ego, and then begin the journey of self-growth and self-refinement, and eventually then reintroduce, as we do with Chametz, to reintroduce that concept and find the good and be able to express it positively. But it never works if we leave the negative there and try to express the good while the negative is there. We have to let go of the negative first and then create a clean slate so that we can then discover the positive. The second concept we talked about was that ego, and by extension stubbornness and rage, actually are the only things that have no good, because they are the forces that conceal good and they stand in the way of good. And they need to be eliminated. So therefore, that concept of being stubborn and being arrogant, as we talked about at length last week, which is the root of not letting anything good in. So the way I am is the way I am. I don't let anything higher into me. I don't let purpose into me, meaning into me, God into me, other people into me, into my space. And therefore, that becomes the root of the evil. So therefore, when we have an emotion, the emotion has some intrinsic good, but the good cannot be expressed as long as there's ego there. So therefore, the ego has to be dealt with and then can give rise for the positive expression. And the third concept we talked about was the idea of hitkalalut. And I explained to you we'll go back to it a bit later, but I explained to you the diagram of the Kabbalistic formula of the various emotions that we have. The chesed and the gvura, the two triangles and so on. And we have this Kabbalistic idea of hitkalalut where they work with each other. So chesed works with gvura. You have gvura in chesed in gvura. And it's only when we let go of the arrogance that we're able to not be so stubborn and therefore be able to let small doses of other emotions come into the mix and into the equation of the emotion that we're dealing with, and that helps create and discover and expose the positivity that's in the emotion. Because we explain, for example, we see this with a child. So when a child is underdeveloped and doesn't have the maturity And therefore a child, by design and purposely, but by design, it's not a problem. It's just the way children are made. It's only a problem if they don't grow out of it. But children are very self-absorbed. That's what a child is. A child only knows their own world. Which is why you see with a child that emotions are extreme. So they're either very happy or everything's terrible, right? That kind of thing. So, however, with trying to refine our emotions and try to discover a pathway of personal growth, we have to learn to be able to manage that and be humble enough to say, well, this is good in this dose, but we need to be able to let other emotions as part of the equation in order to discover the goodness. Okay. So as I said, we're going to talk about the concept of revenge. So before we talk about channeling revenge, let's just spend a bit of time talking about the negative part of what we always imagine revenge is. And then only afterwards we can talk about channeling. So we have to identify what the negative part of revenge is, how we need to let go of that, and then we can talk about how we channel it. So it starts off with actually a verse or verses in this week's Torah portion, which I'm going to show you. It's in context of a discussion. The part that we're actually focusing on is the part in the red, but it talks generally about not hating others. It says, do not hate your brother in your heart. It talks about the mitzvah of reprimanding your kinsmen, reprimanding other people when they do bad, but knowing how to do it properly, but incur no guilt because of him. Then the next pasuk, the next verse says, lo tikom velo titor et b'nei amecha. You shall not take revenge or bear a grudge against your community, against others. And then we have the famous verse which says, ve'ahavta lere'acha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself. Right? I am God. The Torah ends off with. Now the Talmud, and I think the commentator Rashi, talks about the difference between taking revenge and bearing a grudge, and they give that very simple analogy which sort of just captures the concept. So a revenge is defined by someone, A says to B, can you lend me your axe? Remember, we talk about in the context of an agricultural society. And the guy says no. The next day, B comes to A and says, I need a donkey. My donkey is not working very well today. Can I borrow your donkey? And he says, no, I'm not going to lend you my donkey because you didn't lend me your axe yesterday. That's revenge. All right. So what's a grudge? A grudge means where A says to B, can I borrow your axe? B says no. The next day, B says to A, can I borrow your donkey? And A says, I'll lend you my donkey, not like you, who didn't lend me your axe yesterday. In other words, I'm still upset. I'm bearing a grudge. I'm actually upset with you, but I'm going to be better than you. I'm going to lend you my money, right? Okay. So, what's the problem with revenge? What is the issue with revenge? Well, why is it so bad? Now, it's important to understand this, because revenge is an extremely strong emotion, which means it's more about the grudge, actually. That's like often if we mature enough or careful enough, we don't actively take revenge, especially because, I mean, the example with an ox and a donkey is a simple example, but sometimes revenge takes the form of violence and becomes very destructive and can be very, very problematic. And most normal people don't engage in extreme violent acts of revenge. However, sometimes we do subtle things that are more vengeful, and sometimes it's more problematic in being engaged with bearing a grudge than it is with revenge, right? So bearing a grudge, like I walk around angry and I really like to kill the guy, I'm not going to because I'm scared of the police, but I still have the grudge. So what is the problem? So we see in the literature and the commentators and who talk about this and discuss this, that this prohibition, this concept of not taking revenge or feeling an emotion of revenge or even bearing a grudge and still bearing the hate within us is very, very unhealthy. Obviously unhealthy for the person that we take revenge against, but it's extremely unhealthy for ourselves as well on three levels, spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically. What do I mean by that? So, first of all, spiritually, there's the famous works of the Sefer HaChinuch, an ancient author. We're actually not even sure who he was, so we don't know his name. But he was a person who wrote about all the 613 mitzvot of the Torah. He must have lived about 800 years ago. And he goes through every mitzvah, and in every mitzvah or every prohibition, he tries to explain, part of what he tries to explain is the philosophical sort of reason behind it, right? So he brings this in this week's parasha. He quotes, of course, the mitzvah of not taking revenge and not bearing a grudge. And he says something that we've discussed previously, and he says because When a person wants to take revenge, it's a spiritual problem, first of all. Because what it means is that the person doesn't believe in Hashgacha Pratit. It means we don't really believe in divine providence, we don't really believe that everything that happens has a purpose. And he brings the famous idea that fundamental to Jewish belief is that anything that happens to us has a meaning. Right? Everything that happens to us has a purpose. Now, we've explained previously, this can be theologically quite complicated sometimes, because what it means is, because we know that we do have choice, and we've often quoted the famous passage in the Talmud that says, everything is in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven, which means I'm not in control of anything that happens to me, but I am in control of my moral responses, right? Which would therefore mean that so are you responsible for your moral choices, which would therefore, erroneously, we would arrive at the conclusion that if you do something to me, in other words, you made a moral choice that was wrong, and you hurt me, then I have a right to be angry with you, and even to want to get you back, because you were in control of that. And the answer to that is that that's actually not true. That we, and again, this is not the time to go into the theological depth of this and the complexities, but what we do believe is that what happens to me was meant to happen to me. The fact that you had a choice, you had a choice. If you wouldn't have done it to me, something else would have done it to me. In other words, if God wanted me to go through a certain experience, it's going to happen. Your choices are your choices, and it's between you and God, and you're responsible for your choices if they're moral choices. But if something happens to me, I need to believe. Now, I could take protection. That's a moral responsibility, to live responsibly, to make sure you don't do it to me again. I'll put a lock on the door. I'll not interact with you, whatever the case is. But if something already happened, fundamental to Jewish belief is that there's a purpose in it. It was meant to happen. Maybe it's meant to make me a stronger person. Maybe it's just meant to make me learn how to communicate better so I can communicate it with you. But to be violent about it, or to be hateful about it, or to take revenge, that means that I'm angry about the fact that this happened to me. In other words, I believe there was a choice. I believe it didn't have to happen to me, and therefore I'm angry with it. And that's a problem. That's a spiritual problem. We know this very, very clearly, and we've often talked about this. One of the greatest examples of someone who didn't do this was Joseph, Yosef HaTzadik, in Egypt, when his brothers, when they were discovered, when he revealed himself to them, and they were petrified that he was perhaps legitimately going to use his power as the viceroy of Egypt, which he was now in the position of, and he was going to use his power to take amazing revenge against his brothers who had done terrible things to him, that sold him, that sold him as a slave, that misreported what happened to his father, that caused him loneliness and isolation for 22 years, and so on and so forth. And he turns around and says to them, please do not be afraid, I will not take revenge, because you didn't send me here. God sent me here for the purpose of, because it was destined for the Jewish people to come to Egypt, it was destined for there to be a famine, and I was the one who was chosen to be the messenger to provide sustenance. It's one of the most powerful verses in the Torah. Ki lemifya shlachani, because God sent me to provide sustenance. That's an amazing level to be able to. And not only did he take revenge, but he provided for them, and he took care of them, and he was kind to them and compassionate to them, and so on and so forth. They had made a moral mistake, which we find in commentaries, by the way, that we suffered for generations because of Yosef. Right? In fact, I'll just tell you something interesting, just by the way, because we're just coming from Pesach. Some of you, I did say this at a Shira too, so you might have heard this, but you know that on Pesach night, we dip twice. Right? Why do we dip twice? Because there are two dippings. We are told that the Jews went into exile into Egypt because of a dipping, and they went out with a dipping. What does that mean? When Joseph was sold, when the brothers were hateful of him and they sold him into slavery, they took his cloak and they dipped it into goat's blood, which was similar to human blood, and they came back to Jacob, their father, and they said, this is what we found. Do you recognize your son's shirt? Because we think a wild animal has devoured him, right? That was the symbol of what they had done, which was untrue, number one, and it was hateful. And because of that division, division doesn't bring blessing. That resulted ultimately in the Jewish people going down into the exile of Egypt. When they came out of Egypt, the preparation of going out of Egypt was God telling the Jewish people to bring a Korban Pesach, a Paschal lamb. And when he did that, he told them to take a bunch of plants called the Azov, the hyssop plant. I'm not sure what it is myself, but it's a plant of some sort. And they were supposed to dip it into the blood as a not just one plant, but a bunch of them together. and put their blood on the doorpost, and that was going to be the sign of the Jewish homes, right? And the commentaries say that what God was sending them a message was, the exile comes because of conflict and division. Redemption comes because of unity and togetherness. And that's why I want you to take plants which are together, bundle them up together as a symbol of unity, because you need to go out as a nation, as a united people, and that brings blessing and redemption. On Pesach night, we make reference in the Manishtana to the Shtei Pamim, the two times that we dip. This is also the symbolic reference to the two dippings. Okay. So Yosef HaTzadik was able to do that. The brothers were punished ultimately for that, and many things happened during Jewish history because of that. But as far as he was concerned, he saw what happened to him as a mission, as a purpose. So that's the first reason why taking revenge is spiritually unhealthy. Emotionally, it's unhealthy because revenge comes from hate. Revenge is about carrying around hate within our hearts. We've talked many times about the concept that it's never healthy to have hate within our hearts. Hate that festers in one's mind, in one's heart, is destructive, it's unhealthy, it breeds sadness, it breeds dysfunctionality, irritability. All the bad things come when we're in a state, a mindset of hate. And therefore, we have that verse that comes before taking revenge, which God says, do not hate your brother in your heart. The worst thing is to walk around with feelings of hate, right? What we can do sometimes is we can share that disappointment with others in an effective, constructive way. The Shulchan Aruch says, because why did the Torah say you shouldn't hate someone in your heart? Because the real prohibition is to walk around with hate in your heart. If you really are not able to manage it yourself and to get rid of it, you actually have to go and have a discussion with the person. Not revenge, but you have to have a discussion with the person to actually talk it through so that it comes out and it's communicated properly and it's resolved. So hate is a very, very powerful emotion, and it's unhealthy. And therefore, that's one of the reasons the Torah says do not take revenge. But not only do not take revenge, but do not even bear a grudge. Because that's what bearing a grudge is. Bearing a grudge, basically, is carrying around hate. Yeah?
Rabbi, sorry. What happens if they don't want to talk to you?
Good question. Send them an email. No. What if the person, let's say you want to resolve with someone, that's a very important question. But the only thing we can do is we can try, and we can try to get it out and be polite and respectful and work it through in a positive way ourselves and hope that they respond. Doesn't always work, but we hope. Right? Often when we approach it respectfully, that's what brings a respectful response, but not always. Now, psychologically also, it's a very, this concept of taking revenge or bearing a grudge is a really, really, very unhealthy thing, which really is very, very much part of the discussion we had when we talk about the book, The Choice, right? Because bearing a grudge or taking revenge especially, or both really, really goes against everything that's beneficial for personal growth. Why? Because essentially what taking revenge is, number one, it's an abdication of responsibility. In other words, I don't have to do anything to resolve this. I just need to put it completely on you. And therefore, I'm going to show you. I'm going to put you in your place. I'm going to fix you. I'm going to punish you. That's what revenge is. It's I don't take responsibility for this at all. I put it all on you. And therefore, it's a resistance to change that comes from within. Right? If we want to make ourselves more positive, we want to make our lives more positive, if we want to become better people, it might be completely the fault of the other person that something happened, but the journey of change lies within me. The responsibility of change for me is by me. Right? And it's a short-term fix. Revenge is like, it's, you know, they talk about sweet revenge. It's nothing but sweet. It's not sweet at all. But they talk, it's I feel good. I'm going to get it out. It's your problem. I'm going to put it on you. Ultimately, of course, it doesn't work. It's transient. It's temporary. The feelings come back. Hate never goes away unless I resolve it from within. And therefore, that concept is such an important thing, because it's such an important idea to rid ourselves. We try, at least, of that concept of hate and revenge, which again is really much the theme of the choice that we talked about last term, which was her journey to get to a point of not hating and not blaming, taking responsibility, and ultimately even learning to forgive, which definition of forgiveness in this context is letting go of resentment, to let go of that hate, and to work with it. Okay. So that's why revenge is such a bad thing, and bearing a grudge is such a bad thing, walking around with a hateful grudge is such a negative thing. However, and this is the point of this series, revenge can be channeled. And that's what's important to understand. In other words, revenge has some redeeming factors if we channel it and express it in a positive way. So I want to just give a little bit of an introduction to this concept. You know, we talked about the emotions coming from the six primary emotions that we have. Of those six, the primary two is chesed and gevurah, right? Now what that means, just to recap from last week, is that there's many more than six emotions. We have hundreds of emotions. But all emotions track back to one or more of the six primary emotional forces which are in our soul. Chesed, gevurah, tiferet, netzach, hod, and yesod. Right? Now, chesed is all, as we talk about many, many times, chesed is about giving, expanding, loving, connecting. Gevurah is about justice, holding back, discipline, and so on. Which is why often negative emotions, right? Often negative emotions, because negative emotions often is about aggression or violence or hate or rejection of another, often traces their way back to the concept of gevurah, right? Because gevurah is about rejection. So if I'm violent, that's gevurah, because I'm rejecting someone, right? If I'm unkind, it's also gevurah. In other words, because I'm saying no, I'm shutting out, I'm holding back. Gevurah has many positive factors, but often gevurah gets a bad run because many of the bad emotions, many of the negative expression of emotions are rooted in gevurah. But you need to understand that the word gevurah actually means strength. That's what it means. Because what is also true is that the emotions that are rooted in gevurah, negative or positive, are infinitely stronger than the ones that are rooted in chesed. Right? The passion, that's why we find that chesed, the symbol of chesed in the physical creation, is water. Partly because it flows, it goes from on top to below, so it's like giving. The creation, the physical object that is symbolic of gevurah, is fire. Partly because it's destructive, but partly because it's passionate. There's actually much more passion in gevurah than there is in chesed. Kind people, very, very kind people, and sometimes they're extremely passionate about the kindness. But sometimes their passion doesn't come close to the passion of someone who's really angry. Now, that's a bad anger, it's a bad fire, right? But often we find that the bad emotions, the negative emotions, are rooted in gevurah, and because they're rooted in gevurah, they have an incredible strength, an unlimited strength, uncontrolled strength sometimes, right? Which is why we have a concept in Kabbalah, we have this around Rosh Hashanah a lot, this theme, where we try and go through a process called Hamtakat Gevurot, which means it's a Kabbalistic idea of sweetening gevurah. To sweeten the gevurah, to neutralize and transform the gevurah, right? I'll give you a couple of examples. Around Rosh Hashanah time, this is totally misplaced in the calendar at the moment. But we just have to pace us, so we're not thinking about Rosh Hashanah now. But the example is, because Rosh Hashanah is a time we try to draw down blessings for the whole year, right? So therefore, we eat honey. Honey comes from a stinging animal. We've talked about this before, right? It's a gevurah animal, a harmful animal. It's a bee. That doesn't come from a nice, kind, pleasant honey, right? Because we want the blessings to come from the transformation of gevurah. We don't want it to come only from chesed. Right? We blow a shofar. Shofar is connected with the Yitzchak, Avraham and Yitzchak. Yitzchak is the akedah, the binding of Isaac. Why? We know that Avraham is chesed, Yitzchak is gevurah. Right? Why? Because the Kabbalists tell us that blessing that comes from gevurah, if we can get blessing out of gevurah, the blessing is infinite. It's powerful. More powerful than the blessings come from chesed. So therefore, God also has these six emotions. Therefore, we try to draw down blessings. What we try to do is we try to transform our own negativity so that we can in turn create a spiritual, heavenly transformation of gevurah so that we can get the blessings from God coming from gevurah, not from chesed. In fact, in the Talmud, when they talk about the blessing of rain, right? The blessing of rain, for a number of reasons, but the blessing of rain is called gevurot kshamim, the strength of rain. It's such an important blessing, right? The problem is that to get blessing out of gevurah is more difficult because gevurah naturally, by default, lends itself to more of negative expression and destructive expression. because of its power and its force. But the concept of channeling positivity out of negative emotions is actually very much to do with this idea. It's about taking things that are rooted in gevurah and finding the good, because if you find the good, those emotions become incredibly powerful. Does that make sense? Yeah, we're all good with that. And it's a strength which is greater than fire, because emotions that are rooted, positive emotions, that are rooted in gevurah, have a passion and a fire about them that is even stronger than the ones that come from chesed. See, often you find this. You find this with chesed people are very calm. They also, they, because everything goes, like they, you know, yes, they'll give you anything. Like, it's actually a calmness, like water. But the calmness sometimes is a deficiency, because sometimes you need fire. Right? And that's where we find it. We find it in gevurah, which is interesting. So, let's go to revenge. Revenge is very much a fire emotion, very much a gevurah emotion. It's rejection, it's aggression, it's and we find, unfortunately, I mean, if you look at the statistics, you know, which in modern times is more trackable, and we sort of know these statistics, the amount of women, for example, that are killed in domestic violence issues, right? And it's all revenge, that's all it is. It's one emotion, uncontrolled revenge, right? The power that it is in, the power of revenge, is crazy. And the amount of destruction and dysfunction that happens in the world because of the power of revenge is unbelievable. The power of hate, the power of revenge, right? So it's very, very much a gevurah thing. However, in the revenge, in that gevurah, there's a certain fire and a certain positivity which I want to go through. So let's break it down. Obviously, the negative part of revenge is all based, as all negativity is based on, the concept of ego. Like, how could this happen to me? I want to feel good, make the other person suffer. Don't you dare hurt me. You know, you're the one that has to change, not me. I'm going to show you, all this kind of stuff, right? It's all about me. That's what revenge, negative revenge. But at the core of revenge, okay, at the core of revenge, if we take away the ego and just leave the passion, there are some passionate and positive feelings in the process of revenge that can be used in a positive and beneficial way. So I want to talk about three things and then go through them. The three things are a sense of justice, right? So revenge often comes with, like, people who are very into justice often take more revenge than others. Because, like, I can't let this go. Can't go unpunishable, right? That idea. The second thing is, which related to that, is the refusal to be silent. I am not going to stay calm and stay quiet while this evil takes place, right? And the third thing we find with revenge is the refusal to be a loser. In other words, refusal to be knocked down. I'm not going to let that person knock me down. Now, in revenge, all of those things express negatively. So justice means I take justice into my own hands. It's indiscriminate justice. It's not proper justice. It's not fair justice. And I take it upon myself and play God and punish the other person. That's not positive, right? The refusal to be silent is also not positive, because it's coming through ego and therefore it's just about me. And therefore it's normally ineffective, and it's through rage and bad talk and evil talk and negative talk and so on and so forth. And the same thing, like, I'm going to show them, it's more about putting the other person down. There was once a great master of ethics called Rabbi Shlomo Salanter, his name was, and he said that there's two ways to be taller than someone else. One way is to grow, and the other one is to make the other person shorter. Right? So often with revenge, this feeling that I'm not going to let you hurt me is about making sure you become hurt so I can be stronger. Right? So that's all negative. However, these, at the very core, these three ingredients, these three components of revenge, the sense of justice, the refusal to be quiet, and the refusal to get knocked down, are actually in essence good things, if we use them properly and we remove the ego. So let's try and break them down a bit. So there's a fascinating part of, there's a fascinating Talmud which tells us a couple of things about revenge. One of the strangest things about the word for revenge in Hebrew is nekama. Nekama, right? Which means lotikom, which is the word, the noun is nekama. Which we normally take revenge to be a negative thing, right? The Talmud says that any word in the Torah that comes in between two names of God, like a name of God just before the word, just before after the word, means it's an incredible thing. One of those words is revenge, but it's talking about God, not about us. We refer to God as a vengeful God, right? And it's got God's name in before and after. Kael Nekamot Hashem. That's what the verse says. I should have put it up there, I forgot, sorry. Right? Kael Nekamot Hashem. What does that mean? God is a God of vengeance, is it? Right? And it's always a problematic verse for lots of people because lots of people, when they look at the word nekama and they remember this week's parasha, which says you must not take revenge, and in their mind, the imagery of revenge is a very negative thing, which most times it is. So why? God wants to take revenge? Why would God be a God of revenge? And the answer is that no, God is a God of good revenge. Essentially what it means, if you look at the commentary, God is a God of justice. He's also a God of peace. He's also a God of compassion. God is God of many things. But one of the things that God is, which is critical for a functional society, is justice. A God of justice, right? Rabbi Sacks has a beautiful little article where he talks about the confusion and the difficulty in distinguishing between what he calls retribution and revenge. Right? Justice is not always the journey that we need to take, but justice is important. In order for a society to function, in order for good to prevail in the world, because God decided to make a world where there's good and bad, he decided he wanted us to choose good. Inevitably, there's bad in the world. And the only way that bad goes away is if there is some form of justice. So he quotes a very fascinating piece of Maimonides, the Rambam, where we find that negative revenge is replaced by positive justice. So for example, it's the story in the Torah about the person who killed someone else unintentionally, right? Unintentionally, but with careful planning could have avoided it. I guess the best modern term for that is manslaughter as opposed to murder, right? So murder in the Torah is a capital punishment. Manslaughter is not a capital punishment, but it does require what they call running to the cities of refuge. In the Torah, there's a concept of the cities of refuge. They were all over Israel. And it's an exile. It's a process of exile where the person who was responsible for manslaughter, he killed by mistake, but it was some form of negligence involved. He has to run to the cities of refuge and be exiled there for a period of time. Incidentally, it's the closest that the Torah comes to jail, right? The Jewish religion doesn't believe in prison, actually, unless it's just to stop someone violent from hurting other people. That's to protect society. But, I mean, we know the modern statistics are is that jail is hopeless. The amount of reoffending that takes place is amazing, right? Because it has very little or no rehabilitative aspect to it. The cities of refuge were a bit different. It was a punishment. In other words, it isolated the person a little bit. But it was much more in a city, and it was a city together with Leviim, righteous people that used to live there, and they were involved with him and rehabilitating him and so on and so forth. But the Torah says the following. The Torah says that the person must run to the city of refuge because it's also not just a punishment, but it's also a protection for the person. Because if not, there's something that the Torah calls the Goel Hadam, the redeemer of the blood of the victim of murder. We're worried that the relative of the victim is going to kill the murderer, right? So therefore, what the Torah set up was that the person needs to go into the city of refuge where there was much more protection from these potential avengers. And that was like a no-go zone. And if the Goel Hadam would walk into there and even in a spirit of incredible revenge but kill the murderer of the victim, he would be held responsible for a full-blown capital murder punishment, right? So essentially, Rabbi Sacks in this article explains, based on the Rambam, that what was happening here was like this. Justice is something that needs to be done, is important, and is important to have a desire for justice, but because it's so complicated, it can never be taken into our own hands. Right? So I'll tell you a fascinating thing that he doesn't bring in the article, but it's fascinating. The first king of the Jewish people was King Saul. King Saul was a righteous person. However, he was a very humble person, extremely humble person, to the point that his humility got in the way. And he lost his kingdom because he was too humble. He lost his kingdom because God told him to fight certain wars. God told him to inflict punishment on certain perpetrators. And he had Rahmanis. Now Rahmanis is to have compassion is a beautiful thing. But when God tells you to carry out justice, you have to have it within you. Particularly if you're a Jewish leader. And he didn't. And he lost his kingdom. And then God tells Samuel, the prophet, I want you to go to a town and you will anoint as the new king one of the children of Yishai. That was the story of the anointing of King David. Right? Listen to what the Torah tells. Listen to the words. It's amazing. So it was a whole story. Eventually what happened was Yishai presented all of his children without King David. King David was the youngest and he was a bit of a black sheep, apparently, of the family. Another story, very interesting story. And God says, no, got it all wrong. So he says to Yishai, you must have another child. So he says, yeah, but I don't think he's the one. Bring him out. Brings out King David. And King David was an Admoni. He was red. He's a redhead. Right? Shmuel gets nervous. He sees this fiery redhead, very different to King Saul, who's obviously a fighter. And King David was. King David was a warrior. He was a fighter. He wasn't scared to fight wars. So he thinks to myself, okay, I understand. Saul messed up, but this is like the other extreme. This is not going to work. Right? This could cause trouble. Says the verse, listen to this. The verse says he was an Admoni. He was a redhead, but Yefei Einayim. He had good eyes. Nice eyes. Shkoyach. So what's that going to help? So the commentators say he saw something. What eyes? Eyes are a symbol of the Talmud says that the members of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish scholars, the legislators, the leaders of the Jewish nation are always called Einei Ha'eda, the eyes of the congregation. Right? So Samuel saw, this is the king. This is a person who's an Admoni, he's got a sense of justice, he's a leader. A leader has to sometimes apply justice. It's tough. It takes a certain desire that justice needs to be done. But Yefei Einayim, he will never mix his own ego into it. He will only do it by instruction. He will always look to know when is it right and when is it not right. That's the positive part of revenge. By nature, King David had the midah, he had the emotion of revenge, but totally positive. He was able to go and fight God's wars. And he fought God's wars. And in fact, it was only in King David's time, hundreds of years after the Jewish people came to Israel, that all the wars were finally fought and Israel was conquered and Yerushalayim was conquered. They were finally able to build a temple. Mind you, interestingly enough, God didn't allow King David himself to build a temple. Because he says at the end of the day, the temple's not a place of justice. The temple's a place of peace. And you're a warrior, a good warrior, fantastic warrior. A warrior that applied fire and vengeance when it was needed and when it was guided and when it was instructed and when it was selfless. But bloodshed nonetheless, bloodshed is never a happy thing, even when it's necessary. So your son, King Shlomo comes to the word Shalom, which is peace, he'll be the one to build the temple. Okay, so the King David laid the plans. So that's a concept, right? Simon Wiesenthal, by the way, in his book, he called his biography Justice, Not Vengeance. Right, which is a very, very telling thing, and that's probably, you know, justice needed to be done, and that was a good process, but it wasn't coming from a place of vengeance, it was coming from a place of justice. So that's the first good aspect of revenge. The second is the desire and the determination not to be silent. Now, the Talmud again talks about this. It's one of the places where the Talmud talks about revenge in a good sense. It's a very complicated piece in the Talmud because the commentaries battle. Basically, the Talmud says that a Talmid Chacham, a true Torah scholar, must be someone who can take revenge in a very extreme way. And all the commentaries say, whoa, what do you mean take revenge? Revenge is a bad thing. The other piece of the Talmud that all scholars, that great scholars went to, great pious men went to sleep at night. And before they went to sleep at night, they always forgave everyone. They didn't have any personal agendas and personal revenge and so on and so forth. And there's a lot written on this whole subject. And the concept that comes out is as follows. That it's not about personal revenge. But Jewish leaders, and by extension every person, because every person, as we've talked about many times, is a leader on some level, has to be able to call out evil when there's evil. Not from a personal agenda point of view, not from a selfish point of view, but to identify evil. And it's not always easy. And I think, again, on a communal level, this is true on a personal level too, but on a communal level, that's something that we need to highlight, I think, this week particularly. It is unbelievable, and unfortunately this is the world we're living in at the moment, right? It is unbelievable that last week, not this week, but last week was Yom HaShoah, and it was Holocaust Remembrance Day, where everyone talks about never again, never again, never again. Everyone, not only Jewish people, I'm talking about nations, join in with the chorus and talk about never again. And it's been a week where there's been 700 rockets raining on civilians in Israel, 4 people killed, how many people injured, and the world is completely quiet. It's unbelievable. Nothing. Not a word. Isolated here and there. Right? I'm not a guy who's into politics, but in America there's, I don't know how many Democratic candidates, there's about 14 of them or something. Right? None of them have said a word. None of them. Right? It's an incredible thing. Because apathy, sometimes it's more intentional than apathy, but apathy is terribly destructive. We know this too well from history of the Holocaust. Where it's not my problem. I don't want to get involved. I don't want to speak up. I don't want to be unpopular. Right? This is true on a world level, but it's true on an individual level. Often we know we need to speak up. I don't want to get involved. Now, of course, there's ways to speak up, and we have to always... These things are complicated because we always have to make sure that it's not coming from our own ego. It's coming from a good motive. But sometimes it's necessary to call out evil when evil is there. I mean... Just the magnitude of this, I don't know if the world understands this, and we should, ourselves also should never be apathetic about it, right? We live far away, we live in Australia. It's hard to imagine, but if you just think about the numbers, right? There are 1 million people in Israel last week that lived in shelters. 1 million people. That's a lot of people, right? It's not just about how many people are killed, it's people living for a whole week in absolute terror, trauma, kids, young people, and so on, right? It's unbelievable. The magnitude is huge. But we don't think about it. Because the world chooses to be quiet. And therefore, by extension, we all get influenced on some level. But we can't. We have to have the feeling. We have to have the fire. And we have to speak up. Silence is very bad. Let me share with you an amazing idea. It was true before the Holocaust. It's true during the Holocaust. And it's true now. Silence is being complicit. Silence is taking is part of the responsibility, right? So we have... You know, we've talked about this before. There's a concept called the Midrash, right? Now, Midrashim is a part of Jewish learning, but sometimes we have Midrashim that are cryptic, written in a very cryptic way. They have a name. It's called, in Jewish learning, it's called Medrash Pliya, which means a funny Medrash, and it needs insight to decode the Medrash to see what it means. So it's a very, very strange Medrash. You know, in Tanakh, there's a character called Iyov, in English, Job, who lived a life of terrible suffering. It's a big question, who was he, when did he live, and so on. But according to one Midrashic account, Iyov actually lived in Egypt before the Jews were enslaved. Because he was one of the 3 advisors that Pharaoh had. The Midrash says that Pharaoh, this is not the cryptic Midrash, the cryptic Midrash is something else. But Iyov lived a life of suffering. He was one of the 3 advisors. What happened was as follows, that Pharaoh had 3 advisors, Jethro, Bilam, and Job. And he called them one day and says, we have a Jewish problem. What are we going to do with the Jews? They're multiplying, they're growing. Jethro said, no, you have to leave them alone. You have to be kind to them. Pharaoh wanted to kill him, so he escaped and he ran to Midian. Later on, he became Moses' father-in-law. Iyov kept quiet. He's not getting involved. Bilam, which is an open anti-Semite, and said, enslave them, persecute them, and so on. Jethro became Moses' father-in-law. Bilam eventually was killed, and Iyov suffered. So the question is, Iyov actually, at the end of the day, got a worse punishment than Bilam. Bilam lived a good life. At the end, he started out with the Jews, and he got killed, okay? It's a few minutes of suffering. And he lost his life. True. Bad. I live a life of torture and suffering, as Iyov did. If you read the account of Iyov, it was a very, very terrible life. Perhaps a bigger punishment. So why did he get a bigger punishment? So the answer is in this cryptic Medrash. Just last week in the Torah, we learned about the two sons of Aaron that died, Nadav and Avihu. Just bear with me here, because it's a little bit of a journey, so you'll see where I'm going in a minute. Right? Nadav and Avihu, they did something, they went into the tabernacle, they brought a sacrifice they weren't supposed to bring. Anyway, God killed them. So the Medrash says, why did they deserve to die? Because it says that one day Nadav and Avihu were walking behind Moses and Aaron. And Nadav said to Avihu, see those two old men? When are they going to die so we can take over? And because of that, they died. Says the Medrash, when Job heard the story of Nadav and Avihu, he worried. He worried. That's the Medrash. What's Eov got to do with Nadav and Avihu? The answer is like this. The Medrash says that Nadav and Avihu died because Nadav said to Avihu, when are those two old men going to die so we can take over? That's a very disparaging and disrespectful remark to make about Moses and Aaron, correct? So we understand, he would deserve to be punished. But Avihu didn't do anything. Nadav said this to Avihu, Avihu didn't say anything. So why did Avihu deserve to die? Says the Medrash that when Job heard the story, he panicked. He said, ooh, silence is a problem. Avihu didn't say anything, that's the problem. He didn't say, that wasn't a very nice thing to say. That was disrespectful. We really shouldn't be talking like that about Moshe and Aaron. When Job heard that for silence you also get killed, that for silence you also get punished, Job panicked. And what he discovered later was, not that for silence you also get punished, but for silence you get punished worse. Because silence is worse sometimes. It's passive, it's apathetic, it's dismissal, and therefore that one aspect that we learn from the concept of revenge is the determination not to let it go. Now, not in a revengeful way. It's got to be done very carefully. Again, channeling negative emotions are never simple. You've always got to make sure it's not the ego getting in the way. It's always got to make sure that the motives are right. It's got to be done in the right place, in the right forum, in the right context, at the right time, and so on and so forth. But staying silent isn't an option. Speaking up is sometimes necessary and critical, difficult, sometimes confrontational. But particularly people who are in some sphere of influence, or whatever that sphere of influence is, whether it's with family, whether it's with friends, whether it's a community, you cannot afford the luxury of saying, I want to stay calm, I don't want to get involved. So that's another aspect of the positivity of the concept of revenge. And finally, there's another unbelievable idea behind revenge, again, if it's channeled positively. And just, I want to just demonstrate the little story that I heard last week. There was a plane, an El Al plane, flying over Germany. And suddenly it was on Yom HaShoah. And the pilot gets onto the microphone. And he says the following. And there's a recording of it, it's a beautiful thing. He says, I'm an Israeli pilot. All four of my grandparents were murdered by the Nazis. He says, what they would think of their grandson being a pilot, an Israeli pilot, flying over Germany, is unimaginable. And the whole plane erupted in a song. It's so beautiful. They all started to sing, Kol Ha'olam Kulo, Geshet Samuel. You know, the whole world is a narrow bridge, and I know, right? That's real revenge. That's the revenge we need to always focus on. That's the revenge that Edith Eger talks about in her book. That's the revenge. And we should have that revenge. In other words, the revenge should be that if something happens to us, it should bring out a fire. That you say, no, you can't hurt me. I'm going to become a stronger person. I'm going to become a better person. I told you the story many times. It's a similar story about the Kloisenberger Rebbe who started the Leonardo Hospital in Netanya because of a promise he made in the war. And when he used to go between Israel and America, and when the first baby was born in the maternity ward of the hospital, he was in America, and they called him so they should hear he lost his whole family, lost a wife and 9 children, unimaginable. And he heard the first baby cry in the hospital, and when he heard the baby cry, his comment was, that's my revenge. That's a Jewish revenge. That's a real revenge. To say, to get knocked down and say, that's a chobish kin koyach, like I say in Yiddish, I have no koyach anymore left, that's it, I'm going to let it go. Yes, we let it go in terms of letting the negativity go. We must let the ego go. We must let the hate go. We must let the negative revenge go. But we mustn't let go. What revenge teaches us is, no, you don't let go. You become a better person. You fight back positively. You create goodness. And the Jewish nation as a whole knows this well. As individuals, we don't always know it so well. As a nation, we know it unbelievably. The resilience. I mean, just look at the last 71 years. It's just unbelievable miracle, right? Because we don't become victims. We say, no, we're going to become stronger. We're going to create. We're going to innovate. We become more spiritual. On a spiritual level, on an economic level, I mean, there is today, on a spiritual level, there is more people, more Jews, more students learning in yeshiva today than for centuries, perhaps maybe the most in history. It's unbelievable the Torah learning that's going on today. The economic boom, the miracle, I mean, with all the, you know, there's a lot of negative stuff happening too, but we're not perfect yet because Mashiach hasn't come yet. But the miracle, why? Because that's the fighting spirit. That's the true revenge of the Jewish people. So these are the three things that we need to learn from revenge. And that's not only communally and worldly, but also in our own life. If we get hurt, if someone hurts us, we need to let go of the hate. We need to let go of the ego. But sometimes we need to stand up for justice. That's a complicated one. It's another discussion exactly how we do that at an individual level. We certainly have to have that sense of triumph, sense of not getting knocked down. And sometimes we just have to stand up for what is wrong. Sometimes we cannot have the luxury of just saying, I don't want to get involved. Sometimes we have to have a hard conversation. It might be with a child, it might be with a friend, it might be with someone that's hurting someone else. We have to sometimes have that determination not to be silent, because silence is very bad. And when it's done to us, we have to have that fighting spirit to be able to say, my revenge is, we get up again and we keep going and we become a better person and a stronger person. That's the positive lesson. It's the fire, the gevurah, the fire that comes out of revenge. Fire, and that fire is infinitely stronger than just normal positive living. Normal positive living comes from chesed. Chesed is water, it's calm. It's good, it's fantastic. You can live a whole life of chesed, just chesed, and it's very good. You'll do good things, you'll be a great person, and you'll finish time on the planet beautifully. But it won't be close to fire, to gevurah. Good gevurah is unbelievable. And that fighting spirit and that determination is what makes positivity have a quantum leap to a whole new level. Just before we finish, I want to wish everyone a tremendous week, but also we've now launched our raffle. This is a big fundraiser for the year. Please buy one, two, or more tickets. See the office or do it online and spread the word. Have a wonderful week.